Congressional Republicans and Democrats unveil competing budget plans. A number of bills see action at the state capitol, and the Catholic Church elects a new pope. Some of the top stories from the news this week that we will review in this edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, March 15th. Every Friday at this time, we invite two guests from different political viewpoints to discuss and debate the top state, national, and international news stories of the week. And we welcome your input. What issues in the news this week do you want to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, let me welcome our guests. Very happy to have with us David Blaska, former Dane County Supervisor. And his Blaska's Bring It blog can be found at ibmadison.com. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Joy.
And Ruth Conniff is with us, political editor of The Progressive Magazine. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the federal budget stuff. The Republicans and Democrats in Washington unveiled their budget proposals this week. Senate Democrats have already pushed their budget through a committee, and it's expected to go before the full floor next week. Ruth Conniff, let's start with you. What do you think of the Democrats' budget plans?
I think that, when you say plans, are you talking about both? The Senate Democrats have come up with a perfectly reasonable-looking plan that is not—it's not bold, it's not radical, and it's—Paul Krugman observes this morning in the New York Times that it doesn't quite have the courage of its convictions because it makes a very important point that austerity is a disaster in recessionary conditions, has been in Europe, and yet it doesn't push forward and call for the kind of stimulus spending that has triggered the recovery so far, but that could really do something if we were willing to put our money where our mouth is on that. So, it doesn't make huge cuts to entitlements. It doesn't repeal the New Deal, as Paul Ryan would like to do. But it's not an incredibly bold ideological document. It's just sort of a moderate, middle of the road. A lot of people have compared it to sort of a Republican before the Republicans became radicals kind of a proposal. And then what was interesting to me was to see Krugman wave at the Progressive Caucus proposal, which is actually a Democratic proposal with some real guts. And it says, we know that deficits are not actually the threat that face us. High unemployment is a threat. We need job growth. That's what takes care of deficits. It's actually been happening. The deficit has steadily declined since 2009 at the height of the recession. And so what we really need to do is invest in job growth, in infrastructure, in education, and, in our recovery.
Well, David, your comments on the Democrats' plans first.
Yeah, I mean, it took them 4 years for the Senate to come up with a budget. That's got to be a record. Their job is to come up with a budget every 2 years. The Senate Democrats, I mean, their budget comes, they're calling for $1 trillion in new taxes. I know that would make, Ruth Conniff happy, I suppose. It would add $4 trillion more to the national debt. Almost spit my coffee when I heard Ruth say that austerity hasn't worked in Europe. If she means to say that Spain and Greece have been austere, then we've got to go back to your previous guest and get the definition of these words here figured out.
What do you mean by austerity not working in Europe, Ruth?
I mean that those economies are tanking, and I mean this is not a radical or unusual position. You really have to be in a small bubble to think that massive cuts and a failure to do the kind of stimulus that Obama although it was about half of what economists projected we needed to really stimulate job growth, putting money in the hands of people through unemployment benefits, through food assistance to the poor, through investment in education and infrastructure that stimulates the economy and allows jobs to be created and the economy to grow. What we're seeing instead is brutal slashes in government spending. It's the opposite of Keynesian economics, and we're seeing those economies do worse and worse and worse. I mean, the whole world is watching this happen.
Well, but Ruth, you've got to look at the numbers here, and there's this poster with Paul Ryan on, and it's a takeoff on Obama. It looks like the Obama poster, but underneath it says math. Government now consumes almost one quarter of the gross domestic product. I mean, this is historic, and all Paul Ryan would do with his budget is take it down to 19%. It's not like, you know, it's not like we've been austere and it's not working. We haven't been austere. We've been profligate. We are throwing money right and left, and already, you know, the Federal Reserve has this quantitative easing, which I think, you know, it's certainly helped drive up the stock market, and hopefully there'll be no other investments worth anything right now, but hopefully that will filter into the economy. But to say that we've been austere and that's not working, to say that Greece has been austere and that's not working, they haven't been. You know, when you've got Angela Merkel of Germany lecturing President Obama about, then you know that something's upside down.
Let's talk.
Let me just make one quick response to that point, because I think this is probably one of the most important issues in the whole country right now, and that is this peculiar idea that the number one problem we face in America is the deficit, at the same time that the deficit has actually been shrinking. I mean, I think a lot of Americans would be surprised to learn, because of this kind of talk. And by the way, Paul Ryan's budget, this is the third go-round, and the shine is really off. Even in Washington, even his fellow Republicans are saying, this is unserious, it's never going to go anywhere, it's very political, and it's a rehash of the 2012 campaign, which was a big loser for the Republicans. But just on the math, this sort of this claim that somehow he's a math genius and he's right about this stuff, you know, the deficit peaked in 2009, and it has declined every single year since then. It was about 10% at its peak. In 2010, it was 9%. In 2011, it was 8.5%. It went down to 7% in 2012, and the Congressional Budget Office projects that it's going to shrink again for fiscal 2013. So the deficit is going down. It's at a level that economists say is actually not a big worry. The problem for people, and ordinary folks understand this, is that there are not enough jobs. And to say that what we need to do is cut basic programs that help people who are hungry, who need food, to roll back entitlements so that seniors on a fixed income can't get their health care paid for, and that we shouldn't extend unemployment benefits in a high unemployment economy is just, it's bad on the math, and it's morally wrong.
Ruth, come up for air. The fact of the matter is, a healthy economy, Ruth.
All right. David, let David respond to that.
Just a healthy economy is going to do all those things. And that, the great thing about Paul Ryan, I mean, he could, and with some real severe discipline, he's fought back against the, you know, they used to say about Senator Bob Dole and his in his era that he was the tax collector for the welfare state. The Democrats would up spending, and he'd make sure that the, or at least try to make sure that the budget balanced by raising taxes. Paul Ryan is a budget balancer, but he's more concerned. He's been very influenced by the late Jack Kemp in terms of having a growth economy, and that is probably a message that didn't get out as much in the last presidential election, is that this helps the poor. You know, to keep people dependent on the government on your unemployment checks and call that an economic revival plan is almost cruel and unusual punishment.
Let me play a gaffe by Congressman Paul Ryan that got quite a bit of attention this week when he unveiled his budget plan, which would calls for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and a partial privatization of Medicare. And he said this.
This, to us, is something that we're not going to give up on, because we're not going to give up on destroying the health care system for the American people.
So,
David. I love it. Yeah, the truth comes out. I mean, you know, the Republicans are laughing at Ryan with this repeal Obamacare measure because they know it's going nowhere. It's, you know, it's politics. It's left over from 2012. It didn't work then. And, you know, frankly, seniors are not thrilled about the idea that he is going to privatize Medicare. It's just...
Well, I'm one of those seniors.
Right,
I'm one
David.
Of those seniors, and it's I wouldn't be affected. I mean, you do know, Ruth, and we can say for the record here, because I know you forgot to say it, that Paul Ryan doesn't touch anyone over 55.
He has reasserted that. He was flirting with that up until the budget came out.
But I will concede that the repeal of Obamacare is not going anywhere. I mean, you've got a Senate, and that's, you know, that's Democrat, and so that's not going anywhere. We understand that. But he's putting that marker down, saying this is the path that we need to go on, whether we go. So I give them at least the credit for courage.
Let's take some calls. We have Tony in Tomahawk with us. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good morning. I think it's worth mentioning and repeating often that throughout the last 50 years, Republicans have promised balanced budgets. They've never delivered. They've never balanced a budget once. Only Democrats have. And Republicans are absolutely shameless to keep talking about balanced budgets and the deficit and all that. Sure, they've got Frank Putz out there saying the things that he does, you know, trying to get the message. But the American people need to know the truth about balanced budgets. Democrats do it. Republicans talk about it.
Mm-hmm. David? So is Obama one of those Democrats?
Are you serious?
I'm asking a question. You said Democrats balance budgets.
Of course he isn't, and he basically inherited a depression, fool.
All right, don't name call. Don't name call, Tony.
That's not that. I mean, it's, yeah. I know what I am. You don't have
Clinton,
to tell me.
Clinton balanced the budget in part. There was some tax increases.
Yes, he did.
And what the Democrats are calling now is reforming the tax code that would just eliminate some breaks. Really wrong?
I thought Republicans were doing that one. I really did. I think you're wrong on that, Joy. They have talked about that. And actually, they're talking about that here in the state of Wisconsin. Scott Walker.
It's not in Ryan's budget.
Well, Tony, hold on.
That's fine. I don't mind that. It may not be in his budget, but he has the budget. He does not. I don't think he has the tax writing policies. But Republicans have been talking about a flat tax, for instance, which would do that. I know that the progressive, and Ruth, you can see if I'm wrong here, they like to pick the winners and losers, and that's why there's another $100 billion of, I call it pork, shovel-ready projects that, you know, weren't shovel-ready. There's more of that in the Senate Democratic budget.
Well, okay. I mean, this is sort of it's kind of a Punch and Judy argument here. I mean, obviously, I support the stimulus. I thought it should have been twice the size. I also support continuing to fund public education in Wisconsin as, you know, right-wing or rather left-wing radicals like Mike Ellis would like to do. You know, I think we should invest in our future. I think that we should have roads that are in good repair. We should have kids that are well-educated in schools where classrooms aren't overflowing. And just, you know, on a point of fact, the Paul Ryan budget slashes the top tax rate from 39.5% to 25%. So his priorities are, you know, let's cut taxes even further on corporations that just logged their most profitable year in history, right? And one in four profitable corporations in this country pay zero in taxes. Let's slash the tax rates on the very, very rich and on corporations.
Well,
then let's cut Medicare, Medicaid, and food assistance. I mean, it's not, you know, it's sort of silly to even talk about the Ryan budget because it's not going anywhere, but it really does expose what the basic values and priorities of the Republican Party are.
You don't want to comment on
that? Well, sure. I think you're talking about, just so you know what we're talking about here, the 39% is on corporations. Except for Japan, the United States has the highest corporate rate. But I agree with you, and I think Republicans agree with you, Ruth, is that they don't, you know, General Electric, for instance, took advantage of a number of carve-outs and whatnot to pay no tax. That's wrong. That offends, I think, everyone, including Republicans.
Yeah, now, you had mentioned to me, David, that you thought I was wrong when I said the Democrats were calling for tax code reforms. You said the Republicans were. The Democrats are calling for an overhaul of the tax code that would generate $975 billion in additional revenue over the next decade by closing loopholes in the tax code that benefit the wealthy.
Right.
The GOP plan does not increase revenue through taxes.
That's right. There's no increase in taxes. I think the Republicans has always talked about a revenue neutral reform of the tax code. In other words, they're not reforming the tax code as a backdoor to getting more money out of the people. They're reforming the tax code to be more fair so that you don't have a favored few like Solyndra and whatnot, and then others, the small guy who maybe can't afford the full-time lobbyist to get his carve out.
I mean, the kind of loopholes that we're talking about are, should corporations be able to set up a mailbox overseas and hide their profits there so that they don't have to pay any taxes on those profits? These are the kinds of measures that the Republicans oppose.
Let's take John in Somerset next. Hi, John.
Hi. I just want to say is that I think we've got to get serious about cutting wasteful spending and, you know, spending on all these government programs and stuff, where's it getting us? You know,
yeah.
I mean, you look across overseas, you look over at Greece and Spain, they got depression era numbers over there. And if they don't take care of it, then we'll end up just like that's the blueprint that we'll have to follow.
John, what's wasteful spending to you?
Wasteful spending is like buying cell phones for people, you know, that low income people. That's one, you know, I think.
All right. Ruth, what do you say to that?
I'm not aware of a proposal on any side that is aimed at buying cell phones for low-income people, you know, but look, I mean, Greece is a perfect example. I mean, they are in an economic tailspin, and the cuts that they are making, they're cutting off their nose to spite their face. And, you know, it is a very relevant example for this country.
Yes.
There was a time when Paul Ryan and others were very celebratory about the tough fiscal position that countries like Greece and Ireland were taking. And we have seen over these years now that they are in a disastrous economic situation after pursuing these policies. And conversely, we've seen in this country, despite all this hype about deficits from Washington, that in this last several years under President Obama with the very modest stimulus that he did, our deficit is shrinking because we have recovery going on in the country and there's job growth, and that's what takes care of the additional revenue from job growth and also people who are unemployed not being homeless,
Ruth,
but actually
you almost,
having money to buy food.
Ruth, you almost sound like a supply-sider there. And you know, and JFK is saying a rising tide lifts all boats. I agree with you. Economic growth is the key. To say, though, that Greece is in trouble because they've been austere all these years is turning history upside down. They've been profligate all these years. They're having to force to go to austerity because otherwise their money is worthless.
Well, we have to move on to some other issues now too, but related. President Obama said this week that he's talked to the Secret Service about restoring White House tours. He said the Secret Service made the decision to cancel the tours, needing to furlough some agents due to sequestration cuts. Briefly, Ruth, will those tours be reinstated anytime soon? Was the cancellation of public tours at the White House a mistake?
You know, this is probably the one question in this entire program that most interests my kids.
Oh, yeah.
Because we are going to Washington for spring break, and they really want to do a White House tour, and it's just a bummer to have your White House tour canceled. I mean, there's a lot of really disappointed people. But, you know, I hope that we can all tour the White House again while this administration is still there. But, you know, this is a pretty modest problem, actually. It's not, you know, it's not on the scale of the kinds of things that we're talking about. And so, you know, whether we do or don't have White House tours just seems to me to be a pretty minor concern in the context of our whole economy.
Well, exactly. In fact, I was, if you hadn't mentioned the White House tour thing, I mean, talk about a first world problem, Joy. I mean, this is if you remember when President Obama basically was telling these campfire horror stories here about the sequester and how we're all going to suffer, we're all in danger here because we might have $85 billion in cuts out of a $3.8 trillion budget. Well, guess what? The sequester came. I mean, it's like the comet Kohoutek. You know, it was one of the great disappointments, one of the great anticlimactic events of all time. And you know what? We're surviving. We're going to survive. So I hope that your kids have a great time in Washington, D.C. I think they will.
There are other things that are coming up, and we'll talk more about this on Monday. The National Park Service is planning for furloughs and cutbacks, and it's not something that happens immediately.
A nation mourns, yeah. I mean, we'll get through this here. I think we need a fireside chat from Obama to kind of pull us through our hours of grief here.
And it's, you laugh, but I think that'd be great. FDR.
I mean, what else is on? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Happy days are here again. I know. I shouldn't have mentioned because you're going to swoon on us, aren't you, Ruth?
We will talk about FDR. National parks and possible cutbacks in international parks coming up Monday from 6 until 6:50 here on the Ideas Network. We need to take a short pause and welcome more of your calls as we continue to talk about the news of the week. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Talking with Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive Magazine, and David Blaska, a former Dane County supervisor and blogger. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up this afternoon, it's your views on the news after 4 during At Issue. You can continue talking about the top stories of the week after 4 this afternoon. Talking with David Blaska and Ruth Conniff during this edition of our Week in Review. And let me correct where you can find David Blaska's Bring It blog. It can be found at ibwisconsin.com. You can find Ruth Conniff writing for the Progressive magazine. We are talking about the news of the week. We're welcoming your input, too. Let's talk about another national issue. The Senate Judiciary Committee approved legislation banning assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition. The legislation was written by California Senator Dianne Feinstein. Before the vote, she got into an exchange with Texas Republican Ted Cruz. He asked Feinstein if it would be constitutional for Congress to specify that the First Amendment shall apply only to certain books, or not books that Congress deemed outside the protection of the Bill of Rights. And this is how Feinstein reacted to that.
I'm not a sixth grader. Senator, I've been on this committee for 20 years. I was a mayor for 9 years. I walked in, I saw people shot. I've looked at bodies that have been shot with these weapons. I've seen the bullets that implode. In Sandy Hook, youngsters were dismembered. Look, there are other weapons. I'm not a lawyer, but after 20 years, I've been up close and personal to the Constitution.
So Feinstein's legislation bans 157 different models of assault weapons and magazines that can hold more than 10 bullets. David Blaska, your thoughts on the legislation, but that exchange as well.
Well, I hadn't heard that exchange before. I think that was a great question. You know, in terms of speaking of banning books, government lawyers actually did make that argument that you could ban certain books in the Citizens United case. They wanted to ban a film, a movie about Hillary Clinton during the election period. But, you know, the assault weapons, so-called assault weapons, don't have a lot of love outside of people who own them. They are semi-automatic guns. They're more cosmetic than anything. Most hunters have a semi-automatic rifle or even shotgun. It's a step up from the pump shotgun. You have to pull the trigger each time. They're not machine guns. They're not automatic. They're semi-automatic. In terms of the clips, I've seen clips that are crazy with 75s. The proponents say, literally, you press a button and the old clip pops out, the empty clip, and you pop in a new one if you come on. So, you know, if we pass this kind of stuff, I want to say it's not going to do a lot of good, number one. Something like 3% of all homicides occur from long guns, of which an assault rifle would be one. Most of them are from handguns.
Ruth?
I mean, the logic of Ted Cruz's argument is that it would be just a grotesque violation of our constitutional rights if individual citizens couldn't own their own rocket launchers and point them at their neighbors. I mean, it's just not the case that everything and anything goes, or else, you know, we're living in some kind of totalitarian state. And this is a pretty mild bill, really. It's a renewal of the assault weapons ban. It didn't stop people from deer hunting in Wisconsin when it was active under President Clinton. And, you know, we're talking about the kinds of weapons that spray bullets in schools. And we have had this problem repeatedly now in this country. And I think, you know, people who are in this little NRA bubble who make the kinds of arguments that Cruz is making are talking at a theoretical level that is so far from the reality that real people are living with. And that's what Dianne Feinstein was saying. Police officers do not want to confront people who have armor-piercing bullets. And, you know, we do not need to hunt these massive assault-style weapons and these huge clips. It's just not true that we need this. The gun manufacturers who run the NRA want to keep this stuff on market, and that's why we're even having this debate, because the great majority of Americans understand that we have to do something to protect kids from crazy people who walk into schools with these huge weapons. They shouldn't be able to get those weapons.
Bob in Stevens Point joins us. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I agree. I've been a hunter. My background, I'm in the early 60s. My sons have guns. We've been hunting in Wisconsin for years. And this assault weapon problem has gotten real bad in that assault weapons really are designed for military use only. And if you think of going back to when you have hunter education classes, you're supposed to be able to see your target and beyond. And quite frankly, when you're using it for hunting, 1 to 5 shot capacity magazine is enough. That's all. By the time you shoot the first shot or twice or the second shot, you're off target anyway. There's no reason to have a high capacity magazine. Also, just to add my quick comment, I think we should all have background checks no matter what the case is. And they should really, really look at the mental state and the mind of people in general and ban that from being able to be used in society.
Thank you, Bob. We're going to go to Randy in Keewascum, who has another comment on the gun debate, and then we'll get just very brief concluding remarks from our guests on this topic and move on. Randy?
Thank you for taking my call. I guess the hypocrisy of Dianne Feinstein is stunning. In her bill, she exempts public officials from this ban. She thinks of us little people is not, you know, not being good enough to have something that's specifically guaranteed us by the Constitution. As your one guest pointed out, the deal with the assault rifle, it's cosmetic. There's very little difference between that and semi-auto hunting rifles.
All right. Thanks very much, Randy. Where is this going, David Blaska? Do you think we're going to see any changes in our gun laws?
Well, I think you've got people like Joe Manchin in West Virginia and maybe John Tester in, where is it, Montana, Democrats. Others, they're saying there's at least 6 Democrats aren't going to vote for it. I have no particular love for these kind of guns, but as the caller just reiterated, they're no different than other semi-automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm. Ruth, your thoughts on where this issue is going?
Well, you can see where it's going by the vote. You know, I mean, in the Senate committee yesterday is a straight party line vote. The Republicans voted against every provision in this bill, and they're going to filibuster it on the floor. But I think what has happened is that public opinion has really shifted, and that is challenging the power of the NRA because that's just not where people are. People are not willing to accept the idea that murdering children in an elementary school is just the cost of doing business, and we can't do anything about it. And I think that ultimately that public pressure is really beginning to challenge the power of this lobby, this very specific and out-of-it lobby.
Let's move on to another somewhat legal issue, maybe not quite the serious issue as gun control, but New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg says that he plans to appeal a state judge's ruling that struck down his ban on the sale of large sugary drinks. The city was set to prohibit the sale of sodas and other sugary drinks in containers larger than 16 ounces, but the judge ruled one day before that ban was to take effect, said that the rule was arbitrary, and Blaska said, though, Bloomberg said that he was going to appeal.
I've got to defend my children and you and everybody else and do what's right to save lives. Obesity kills.
So, David Blaska, what do you say to that?
I would say from my cold, dead hands.
Your sodas?
You're not going to take sodas? This is progressive. This has got to be progressive heaven. I think, you know, Ruth, you're probably just, you know, in a fainting spell here. This is Michael Blue. Because the experts say, and they can't, you know, we groundlings cannot be trusted to make our own decisions. We have to have laws that tell us what to do from our betters. And if you get elected mayor of New York and if you make $1 billion like Michael Bloomberg, you must know something that we don't know. So I understand that. But this is, I mean, this is prohibition all over again. You know, there was a lot of alcoholism. So they said, we're going to ban all booze with enough carve-outs to you know, keep a lot of wineries going. But this is prohibition redux.
Ruth.
So, yeah, it's not a big surprise to me where David Boyce stands on this issue. But, I mean, I have to say, the Progressive Magazine is a civil libertarian, you know, edging towards libertarian on many positions magazine. I mean, we supported Rand Paul's filibuster. So don't make a, you know, one big, huge tent of a stereotype out of this. And Bloomberg is a Republican. Let's point that out, too.
Was.
So you know, this...
Well, he's not anymore. I mean, he's not. Let's be accurate.
But you know, it is an enormous problem. For the first time in history, we have kids who have type 2 diabetes in childhood and are at the same time malnourished. And so I have a lot of sympathy for Bloomberg looking around and saying, in this sort of benign dictator way, I'm going to personally do something about this. I'm going to protect these kids. Because it actually is a public health emergency what's happening. And that kids are being raised drinking, you know, these giant 20-ounce sodas and little else is an absolute appalling situation. And, you know, on the other side, we have the corporations that sell these drinks, the American Beverage
Association.
Oh, the
corporations, the evil corporations.
The American Beverage Association that's saying, we are absolutely going to keep making our money in the inner city selling this junk to kids who are now really on the road to death. I mean, this is not a small issue. But you're right. I mean, it is prohibition. And people have, it's very easy to lampoon what Bloomberg is doing, and it's probably not going to survive this challenge to try to reinstitute it, because it does, it veers into protecting people from themselves, and that's a real problem.
Ruth, it took you 37 minutes to utter the phrase evil corporation. That's got to be a record
for you.
You
uttered it. You've got it.
And I made a note here for my blog. Ruth Conniff has come out in favor of benign dictatorships. Good.
No.
That's what she said.
This is the fair and balanced approach of the right. Like, this is great, because now listeners can hear, when you're reading the Blaska blog, this is how he reports what you just heard.
Well, what did you just say? Do you favor this or not?
No, I mean, I don't.
Okay, good. That's good.
Let's talk about another big issue for the world's 1.2 billion Catholics. We have a new pope. David Blaska, what do you think of the new pope, Pope Francis?
Habibim Papem. Frankie One, I call him. I like him. Someone said that he looks like Ed Wynn. I'm old enough to remember Ed Wynn, who was old when I was young. He's got this grandfatherly uncle look to him. Apparently he's a strap hanger down in Buenos Aires. Speaks Italian with a Spanish accent. That's what they said. I'm kind of curious about that. He's a Jesuit, and they're noted for their rigorous thinking. I wish he was 56, not 76.
Any thoughts, Ruth?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a hugely significant symbol. It is the first pope from Latin America, and that's obviously where Catholicism is going. I mean, you can look at a map and see where all the Catholics are, and it means a great deal to Latin American people. You know, I think that his reputation for caring about the poor, his sort of humble approach, his renunciation of the throne, the fact that he, you know, wants people to come in the elevator with him, he took the bus to work, you know, some of that is not going to be the case anymore now that he's Pope, but he brings a kind of a humble aspect that really emphasizes the best part of Catholicism, which is, you know, a spirituality that truly cares about the poor. On the flip side, in Argentina, he was a priest who did not speak out against the military dictatorship there, even as 30,000 people were being murdered and disappeared. And the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina are not thrilled with his selection, because to them he represents being on the side of the ruling class and the military dictator against the poor. So, you know, it's symbolically significant, and there's a lot about it that is heartening, but there is that caveat. He's very conservative. He's allied with the right wing in the church, and you know, that history works against that image that we're hearing a lot about of his humility and his sympathy for the poor.
Ruth Conniff is political editor of the Progressive Magazine. David Blaska, former Dane County supervisor and author of Blaska's Bring It blog. We will continue reviewing the news of the week. We're going to turn our attention to state issues, including the mining bill being signed into law, and many more state issues. That's awesome action this week coming up here on the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine with David Blaska and Ruth Conniff. It's time for the Week in Review quiz question now. It was a good week for Wisconsin as Wisconsin won another major cheese competition. A cheesemaker in Thorpe took home the first place in the U.S. Championship Cheese Contest for her particular variety. What kind of cheese won first place in the U.S. Cheese Championship Contest? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will be entitled to one of the books that we have featured on the program recently. We'll have the answer and the winner at the end of the Week in Review. We'll also ask you to call your answers in or email your answers in the next 5 minutes or so. So do it now and not later. All right, let's talk about some state issues in the news this week. We had a Wisconsin appeals court refusing to put on hold a judge's decision repealing major parts of Governor Scott Walker's law that ended collective bargaining for most public workers. Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen asked the 4th District Court of Appeals to place the September ruling of a Dane County judge on hold while an appeal is pending. Judge Juan Colas refused in October, and the appeals court on Tuesday upheld that decision. It's still more action to come on this, but Ruth Conniff, your thoughts on that decision?
Well, obviously it's a good thing. You know, I think the important thing to remember is that the issue in this case was the unequal treatment by Walker in this law of his political allies in the police and fire unions and his political opponents in the public service. Other public service jobs, and it was just so clear that he was playing favorites and that he was treating these two unions completely differently, telling one, you know, that they could no longer collect dues, that they had to take a poll of all workers, including those who weren't in the union, in order to appoint officials, you know, this a whole variety of things that have basically eviscerated the ability of public sector workers in our state to organize and represent themselves, to bargain over wages and conditions of employment. And then for his political allies, he gave them a pass, and the judge looked at it and said, this stinks. It's just completely unfair.
David?
Well, it's first of all, we know where this is going. It's going to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and that's why April 2nd is so important. Ed Falone is the candidate if you want to overturn Act 10. Patience Rogensack is the candidate if you want to keep it. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Look, a federal judge, actually a federal circuit court of appeals last year ruled on the same issue. I mean, there's so many of these court cases they're hard to keep track of. But basically they said the state government had a rational basis for making that distinction. And we have to understand, too, what the state granteth, it can taketh away. And we did not have public sector government employees with recognized collective bargaining rights until 1959. 24 states, last I checked, still don't. In fact, Barack Obama's, most of his employees in the federal government outside the post office cannot bargain for their wages.
I mean, the right to bargain collectively is not a privilege granted by the governor of Wisconsin. It's a fundamental worker's right.
No, it's not. It's not in the Constitution.
Really, it really comes down to the issue of whether you think that people in a workplace should have any leverage whatsoever ever to not to have control over what they're paid and their hours of work and other issues, but whether they can even sit at the table to discuss that. And this attack on labor rights in Wisconsin was obviously an enormous national flashpoint. It's turned, you know, Walker's visiting Iowa now, and he's, you know, he's got a lot of support from the right on this. But really, you can see in this case really highlights that what's at stake here is not that somehow it's unethical for workers to be able to come to the table and bargain, but that these folks are who he recognizes as his political opponents, and if the Republicans can take down unions, they can defund the Democratic Party, and just like redistricting, they can lock in power by, you know, rolling over the majority opinion.
Let me mention that we will have the candidates running for state Supreme Court justice on our state capitol report on Monday between 7 7 and 8. We have Justice Pat Rogensack from 7 until 7:30 and the challenger, Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone from 7:30 until 8. You can call in with your questions for the candidates for State Supreme Court Justice on Monday from 7 until 8. Ruth Conniff, David Blaska said that this is headed to the state Supreme Court, and if you want Act 10 overturned, you vote for Ed Filone. If you want it upheld, you vote for Patience Rogensack. Do you agree?
I do agree. I think the Supreme Court election is incredibly important, and you know, Patience Rogensack is the chief water carrier on the court for Walker and for business interests in the state. She's the single most highly rated member of the Supreme Court by business interests, which is really saying something when you have a court that includes Michael Gableman and Prosser. She is really, you know, she's sort of a poster child for everything that is wrong with what's going on in Wisconsin. It's just the, you know, the incredible influx of money into these Supreme Court races, the degree to which our Supreme Court is now being purchased by out-of-state interests. And really, I think this has got to be a very important race for people. But that said, it's hard to get a candidate, and it's hard to mount a challenge because of the incredible financial power of an incumbent like Rogensack. So, you know, the more people hear about Ed Filone, the better.
You want any more comment on the race?
Well, just, you know, let's not just, you know, Scott Walker has support from the right. I mean, you know, you folks helped make him a rock star. I know, Ruth, you wrote a piece for Progressive there, bemoaning the fact that we're just down to the lonely Solidarity Singers in the Capitol Rotunda. You would like to have that the Days of Rage come back. The fact of the matter is that we had Governor Scott Walker underwent two elections within two years, and he only increased his margin. And interestingly enough, Act 10, if any state senate or assembly candidate made that their issue in the fall elections, it escaped my notice.
Let me move to another issue. An affidavit filed in federal court says documents were deleted from state redistricting computers last year, even after lawmakers' aides were told to preserve all records. The discovery raises the possibility that Republican officials or their attorneys could face sanctions from a panel of three federal judges that are overseeing this case. Well, Ruth, what's going on here?
I mean, this is the latest chapter in this incredibly corrupt process of redistricting that the Republicans, they created this new map that locks in Republican power by drawing these preposterous districts. They did it in a back room at the law firm Michael Best and Friedrich in secret, and then have refused repeatedly to cough up documents explaining what their process was and who was involved. And the court has already sanctioned the law firm $17,000 for its contemptuous and preposterous arguments that attorney-client privilege protects the Republicans in Wisconsin from having to tell the public what they're doing when they're drawing districts, political districts in our state. So now they finally cough up these hard drives, and they've been erased. One of them is all dented and banged up, clearly having had the metal housing removed. They've got software to erase documents on the hard drives, and they're missing a whole bunch of information. So I think this is very serious jeopardy for the law firm Michael Best and Friedrich and for the Republican legislators who are involved in this incredibly corrupt process.
David?
Well, this is a sideshow. I hope that everything's on the up and up with that. I'm not, you know, if they are trying to evade a court order, I'm not going to approve that. But let's understand something. None of this changes the redistricting. Redistricting has undergone its own legal challenge and has been found to be substantial, solid, democratic, according to Hoyle and the whole thing. This is more of when Democrats don't get their way, they go to the courts or they go to Illinois. You know, the fact of the matter is, and I hear a lot, Joy, about, well, the only reason the Republicans are in the majority in the legislature is because of this redistricting. The fact of the matter is, the Assembly is at 60-39. The Senate is 18-15 Republican. That's what it was before the redistricting. You had dealing with these fantasies, I think, Ruth, is just not going to do your site any
good. All right,
good.
So here's the actual reality. In this redistricting, Wisconsin eliminated every single competitive congressional district in our state, which is why Paul Ryan, who lost his hometown of Janesville and his home neighborhood, is still in Congress. It's why Democrats got 1.4 million more votes for the House of Representatives overall in our country, but Republicans still control that chamber. It's this gerrymandering is what is allowing Republicans not only to hold a lock on Wisconsin, where particularly in the assembly, there are now almost no competitive seats. There was only one out of 16 state Senate seats that was competitive in the last election. And this is their plan, to hold this lock on power with these ridiculous maps that they made in secret with their lobbyists and don't want to share the process with the public. When the courts drew the maps in Wisconsin, which is the way it used to be before the Republicans gained the control that they gained, it was actually a competitive process. Ruth. Republicans have pretty much tried to do it. And the next step that they're talking about on a national level is to make the Electoral College based on these gerrymandered congressional districts so that they can win the White House and lose the popular vote. That is really what's at stake.
David,
Ruth, first of all, in the state, just take the assembly, the 99 members, 59 races were run by incumbents, incumbent Republicans. And I should say 45 of the 76 contested districts were run by incumbents. Democrats were only able to field 12 of the 76 incumbents. Incumbents have always had an advantage.
Well, let's pick that up another time because we're almost out of time. And Governor Walker signed the mining bill into law this week. Republicans have been working on this for the better part of 2 years to get it passed. They say that this iron mine or possible iron mine in northern Wisconsin would create thousands of jobs. Democrats say it will lead to pollution and there are lawsuits being planned. Do you think, David Blaska, that this mine will ever see the light of day?
Yeah, it will, but we're going to try to find a Dane County judge to delay it. I mean, that's been the modus operandi. I guess, you know, progressives know how to cure poverty, but they can't figure out how to pull iron out of the ground. You know, I just want to say there was it's called Copper Park now. It's in the northwest part near Ladysmith. There was an open pit mine there. It closed in 1997. Federal suit was brought. Judge Barbara Crabb she's based here in Madison and also in Eau Claire in the Western District. She referenced the company's, quote, exemplary efforts to protect the environment during its mining operations and reclamation effort. These efforts deserve commendation, not penalties. The fact of the matter is there's a park there now. It's a lake. It's called Copper Park. It was an open, and the Flambeau Mining Company ran it. And it's also, I think, ironic that one of the most persistent polluters in the state of Wisconsin is the Bad River Band of the Chippewa Indian or the Ojibwe.
Because we have less than a minute, Ruth, very briefly, are you concerned or do you think this mine will ever see the light of day?
I think likely it will not because it will be tied up in federal court because the Ojibwe have really an open and shut case that this is a violation of their sovereignty and the repeal of environmental regulations to serve the interests of this company that wrote the bill, as Governor Walker himself said. It's just totally overthrowing our democracy. Plus, the Army Corps of Engineers says it'll take 4 years to even approve a permit and get the thing going. It's a handful of jobs, and it's going to be tied up forever.
All right. A quiz winner is Dirk in Mequon. Congratulations, Dirk. He correctly answered that the first place in the U.S. Cheese Championship contest in Green Bay this week was a Thorpe cheesemaker who made a variety of cheese, Gouda. It was Gouda cheese. The Holland family cheese won the two-day competition. The mature Gouda scored 98.31 points out of a possible 100. So congratulations to Holland's family cheese in Thorpe for the gold medal winner, Gouda cheese. So, David, what's your favorite cheese?
Oh, I think maybe Havarti or something like that. Any blue cheese would be good. Stilton.
There we go. Yeah. Ruth, favorite cheese?
I'm going to agree because I think we should agree at the end of the show. I love Havarti cheese and also blue cheese.
There we go. Well, happy St. Patrick's Day this week and have a good weekend.
Thanks a lot
for being with us. Ruth Conniff, editor of the Progressive Magazine, political editor, and David Blaska, former Dane County supervisor and author of Blaska's Bring It blog. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.